Okay, now I get to present tonight's speaker, and his name is Cliff, well-dressed Cliff, from Imperial Beach, right.
All right, now it's my turn. Cliff Hogan, alcoholic.
Hi.
Yeah. Wow, okay. Sobriety date, when did I get sober? June 28th, 2013. That's when I got sober. My son informed me the other night that I had a leg up when I got here because I already knew the secret handshake. Yeah, they used to call me Half Cup around here. Yeah, people were following me around with a mop all the time. Let's just start at the beginning of it all. When I was out there drinking, it was all on. It was on. I got to a point in my drinking where I was drinking every day, 24/7. Could not stay away from it. I tried AA a few times, but I always tried it for the wrong reason. I was having back problems, and so I was just going to AA. I was trying to get everybody off my back. It never worked for me for that reason, you know? And I got to the point in my drinking where I knew for a fact I was going to die from one of the diseases to go along with alcoholism. I knew for a fact that was going to happen because I'd seen a few of my friends die that way. And if you've ever been to the hospital to visit somebody who's dying from alcoholism, it's an ugly, ugly death. Slow, painful, ugly. There's no other way about it. And I knew that was my future. There was no doubt in my mind that's where I was going. And it scared me. So much so that I knew that if I kept on going, which I was going to, that's where I was going to be. So I went down to the local liquor store and got as much alcohol as I could afford and put it in me as fast as I could because I knew that would kill me. And if it's going to kill me, take me now. I don't know. When I got here, I thought I was unique. I didn't think anybody else had tried to do that. My son found me dying on the pavement. Called 911. I got to the hospital in time and woke up there. And I realized two things. I had no idea how I got there, and I had no idea what I was going to do next. But I realized two things right then and there when I woke up. Plan A didn't work, so it's time for Plan B. And I don't know about you guys, but I've always got a pocket full of Plan Bs. I do. I really ask Judy. She'll tell you. I've always got a Plan B going. Plan B was AA. And I didn't tell them at the hospital that I had tried to commit suicide because I knew they would have kept me, and I did not want to stay there. And so I was checking myself out of there. It was at Grossmont Hospital. I was checking myself out, and they asked me if I had a ride. And I said, oh, yeah, I've got my cell phone. And I get out the door, and I start dialing numbers, and nobody's answering. The phones are ringing. Nobody's talking to me. I'd been dropped off at a few other places, taken to a few other places, and didn't stay. And they were done with me, absolutely done with me. Now, even the guys I used to drink with were done with me. Nobody was answering the phone. So I walked from Grossmont Hospital to Hammershaw Road at night. And I don't even know what day it was. That's how I had been in a fog for a long time. I walked. And I didn't take Hammershaw, I didn't take Sweetwater Road. I'd driven down that road too many times drunk, and I was already unstable. I didn't want to fall into traffic and die because at this point, I wanted to live. For whatever reason, I knew that my life was now in God's hands. I knew that for a fact. So I started walking those back streets, and I was talking to the only one that was listening to me, and that was God. And I wasn't having a little quiet conversation, walking down, whispering. No, I was talking out loud to God. And I'm sure that these people that lived on those streets were going, what the hell is going on out there? You know, I'm surprised the cops didn't show up. I really am. I got to my ex-wife's apartment where I was staying in her garage. And Got up the next morning, and I knew what I needed to do. I needed to get to some place where I could be safe, away from alcohol. So I went to the Alano Club in Lemon Grove. And I stayed there all day. I was super afraid to leave that property. I knew what I would have done. I've seen me do it before. And at this point, I was really, really afraid of alcohol. So I stayed there all day. I did that for a few days. It kept me sober. I was getting rides back to the apartment. And finally, I found out about this place here. And finally, we found out that, you know, got the address and all that, and came down here, and they said, come on down, we might have a bed for you. Come in and put an application in. My son was really pivotal on that. I had no idea where this place was. I wasn't even sure that I knew the address. I think he is the one that got the address. By the way, he's sitting right back there. Raise your hand, son. That's my baby boy, Christopher. So he's the one you can blame for me being here. So we finally found the address. It was on that little plaque out there, a little tiny plaque that says 270 C Street. We drove by, a couple times anyway. Now I finally went, hey, look, there it is. And he said, tuck and roll, and pushed me out. I said, what? Blah, 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 blah. He came in here with me and went in the office and told him, watch him, he's a runner. I had been dropped off at too many places before. Well, I was done running. I was absolutely done running. I had gotten beat up by alcohol for the very last time. And my first day here was really super cool. I get here, and they're having a barbecue out back, and there's a party going on, and I'm like, man, this place has got it rocking. This is a good place, you know? And they show me my bed, and I'm like, okay, well, I got a bed. I'm not living in a garage. I'm doing okay. Got to share with a few other men, but that's okay, you know? Not jail. The doors aren't locked. You know, I'm doing okay. And I get up the next morning expecting, you know, like continental breakfast of some kind, you know? Something going on. I get down here, and there's a bowl of cereal. And I had to serve it myself. Okay, so that's when I realized the day I got here was actually the 4th of July. That's how I didn't realize it was the 4th of July. That plays a little bit later on. That comes up a little later on in my story. My first Monday night men's meeting here. All these meetings when you first get here are mandatory. And I really appreciate that. My first Monday night men's meeting, a guy got up here and he talked about committing suicide with alcohol. And I had no idea anybody else had figured that out. I went, wow, I got to talk to that guy. Because he had what I wanted. He was sober, which I wanted really much. And he was happy, which I didn't know those two things were in the same people at the same time. Had no idea. I thought in order to be happy, I had to be loaded. Even though I wasn't happy when I was loaded. I mean, I'm sure you guys understand this. So I went and talked to that man after the meeting. They called him Cookie Tom. And at that point, I didn't realize why they called him Cookie Tom. Remember, I'm still pretty fogged over. I'm still, after I had been sober for a while, I went down and got tested for wet brain because I really thought I had it. And they said, no, you're going to be fine. I was really concerned about that. I was having problems keeping, you know, sentences together and carrying a cup of coffee and, you know, just doing normal stuff. But anyway, he brought homemade from scratch cookies to the men's meeting. And that's why they called him Cookie Tom. I asked him to be my sponsor and he said, yeah. And I was shocked. He took me to the book. He told me where he lived. He actually told me where he lived. I hadn't had anybody do that for a while. So I went to his place just up around the corner here. And I got there with my big book, walked over there. And On the table was his big book and a dictionary. And we're not talking a little, you know, pocket size. We're talking one of those lethal weapon ones, you know. You could pick it up and, you know, have one of those. And we would get to a word that I thought I knew the meaning of. You know, like thoroughly, honestly, completely, you know. These really simple words. And he would have me look them up. And we wouldn't go to the first definition, because that's always the latest edition. We would go to the very first meaning of the word. Because he figured out early on that I needed my AA the same way I needed my alcohol. Straight up and strong. Don't you put any ice in it. I needed it straight up and strong. And that man told me what needed to be done. He didn't suggest. He told me what needed to be done. And the difference this time was I was willing, absolutely willing, to do what this man said. And I listened to what he had to tell me. It made a huge difference in my life. Huge difference. I get to do things today that I didn't get to do before. I get to go sailing. I get to come to meetings. I get to have a wonderful girlfriend. I tell you, this girl right here is amazing. If you don't know Judy, you need to get to know Judy. She's a blast. She's a lot of fun. This is a God gift. And you know, I've gotten a lot of those God gifts since I got here. And I've watched a lot of other people in my life get God gifts. And it's amazing to watch. It truly is. One of the first things that I got in sobriety was my family came back into my life, my children. That was huge. Because I had alienated all of them. Even my son here, he was almost completely giving up on me. I'm sure of it. And you know, at that point in my drinking, I didn't think I was bothering anybody else. It's my drinking. It's not you. It's my life. I want to live it the way I want to live it. Because I was so closed-minded to how much my life affected everybody else around me. Had no idea. I was completely selfish. And after being here for a while, I get to see how much my life affected everybody else. My mom never really gave up on me. She loved me all the time. My sister never really gave up on me. She would never enable me, but she never really gave up on me. She told me one time, she said, I'll pay for your rehab. And I thought about it for a minute. I thought, no, you know what? Keep your money. I'm not ready. I'm not done. One time she invited me over to her place up in Northern California when I was living up there. And she said she needed some work done around her place. So I get over there, and she says, sit on the couch. We need to talk. I said, all right. So I sit down, and she said, we got to talk about your drinking. I said, okay, what's up? She said, you got a problem. I said, no, I don't have a problem. I drink, I fall down, I get back up and drink again. She says, that's not funny. This is your intervention, and I'm the only one that showed up. That's how alienated I was from everybody else. And I've come from, that wasn't enough to get me to stop drinking. There was plenty of times that I had opportunities to quit or to stop, and I didn't take. But this last time is the one that stuck. You know, and my mom got to know me sober before she passed. Mom was pretty cool. Mom was really pretty cool. That lady, she's 4'11". She swears she was 5'2", but she was 4'11". My brother and I we measured her out when she was asleep on the couch one night. She was 4'11". Swore she was 5'2", though. The way I hear it, I was too young to know that what this had happened, but my dad had come home drunk and beat on her. Mom didn't put up with that from anybody. I didn't know this about my mom until a little later in life. But Mom didn't put up with that from anybody. And he was in the Navy. They were living in Florida on a Navy base in Navy housing. And he beat on her and then passed out on the bed. And she went in there and wrapped him up in the bed sheets and beat the shit out of him with a frying pan. I swear, this is what this is. My dad told me this story too. It wasn't just mom. My dad told me too. I was like, man. And then she packed all the kids up, three kids, in Florida. On the way out of the gate, she stopped at the guardhouse and told them to go check on him and left. She didn't stop until she got here in San Diego. She had family in San Antonio that she didn't stop to see. She came straight to San Diego to get as far away from him as possible. Thought she might have killed him and didn't care. Now, this is back in the 60s when women with children that were divorced were not as respected as they are now. And I'm sure a lot of you women understand what I'm talking about. It was not a good time for them. Mom put herself through school. Became a bank teller. Well, the way she put herself through, this is pretty cool. The way she became a bank teller by putting herself through school was, she was a go-go dancer in downtown San Diego. Mom was a little hottie. Yeah. Yeah. She was a powerful woman, though. She was a very powerful woman. She put herself through school and became a bank teller. And then she kept on going to school, and she got to be a secretary. And then she got to be a secretary to the president of Bank of America at the branch. And then she worked her way up till she was the senior vice president's secretary to Bank of America in San Francisco. She worked her way up in that company. That woman was an amazing woman. I salute her every time I get a chance. And I like telling that story. I know that she would have been embarrassed by the fact that the way she started, but the way she stopped was amazing. That woman really, the only problem she really had, you know, I get to thinking about it, she really enjoyed getting married. She had five husbands. The last time she was going to get married, she had called my brother, and then she'd called my sister. These are my half-brother and sister. They were older than me by a few years, so I was my mom's second marriage. She'd called my brother and sister and told them that she was going to get married, and then she called me, and she said, I'm going to get married. I said, well, you know, Mom, you should probably just go ahead and get the divorce papers started now. And boy, she got pissed. That woman had a mouth. Let me tell you, she had a mouth. She got really mad. She goes, you've been talking to your brother and sister? I said, no. She goes, they told me the same thing. I said, well, Mom, Mom was pretty cool, though. Mom was pretty cool. So she was real proud of me for getting sober. Every time I would go up and visit her, she would introduce me to her friends, and she'd go, this is my son Cliff, and he's in AA. Like, anonymous, Mom, anonymous. Wasn't going to work. She was real proud. Because I put that woman through some stuff, too. You know, so it was really good to get to know my sober mom. It was really good that my mom got to know me sober. Made me feel really good about how things ended. Mom ended up with dementia and Alzheimer's. Pardon me. Got to pop one of these cold ones open. I got some looks. I saw that. I got some looks. So we were putting Mom in a home. And my brother and sister were in town doing all the paperwork for that. And my family's got a weird sense of humor. I was able to be involved with this because I had been sober for a few years, about 4 years when we did this. And I felt real good about the fact they're involving me. I thought it was really cool. We're getting everything settled, and there's a notary there, and we're getting all the signatures we need, and the doctors see things, and all this stuff. And the notary's all done, and he's putting his stuff away, and my brother turns to me and he goes, okay, so we can harvest the organs, right? The poor guy that was doing the notary, he's like, what? The humor we have in our family is kind of fun. Anyway, after Mom got that, we got passed with that. Mom didn't stay there for very long. We put her in some memory care, and we did some other stuff for her, and when she first went to this one place where there was a lot more care than she had been used to, she she had her gin and tonic that she would have every evening. One gin and tonic, and that was it. The mom was a normie, as far as that goes. I don't know about everything else, but mom was normal in that aspect. So they called me up one day and told me I needed to come up and help them with my mom. My sister was out of town. My brother was out of town. So I get up there, and they tell me that mom is getting really agitated in the evening, and the medications that they have her on, when she takes her gin and tonic, it affects her to make it really, really agitated really easily. And then they showed me a video of mom, not with any sound, but if you knew my mother, you would understand. Because I know anybody that has a mom that has any kind of pointing finger thing or anything like that, you know what's happening without any sound, right? And she walks up to the receptionist desk, and this poor receptionist, she's sitting there, just nodding her head. Mom's doing this to her. And then she puts a hand on her hip. She's going like this again, and I can almost hear what's going on. There's no sound, but I can almost hear what the poor lady's going through. And I look over, she's sitting there, she's got a smile on her face while we're watching this, and then she has the double hands and the foot stomp. I'm like, oh no, this poor girl's really getting it. Turned to the lady and I said, you know, I'm really sorry. She said, your mom's a doll. We just need to get rid of the booze that's in the room, and legally we can't do that. So that's why you're here. I'm like, okay. So I go up to my mom's room. And I'm talking to mom about this. And I said, I tell her what's going on. And I said, so I'm going to have to, where's your gin at? And she said, oh, it's over the sink. So I go in the kitchen and I take the bottle and I start pouring it out. And I hear from the living room, well, there's a switch. Thanks, mom. But she was real happy that I was sober. Because I was sober, because I'd done the work that needed to be done, which I owe my life to, I was able to hold mom's hand when she passed a couple of years back. My sister was out of town. My brother wasn't available. It was rough. Mom meant a lot to me. And to be able to be there when she passed was amazing. It hurt. And I knew exactly what I needed to do after that happened. The first thing that came to my mind wasn't a drink. The first thing that came to my mind was get myself to a meeting. It was the first thing that I did. I looked up in the app and found a meeting close by the hospital, and I went straight there. And it worked. It worked. And you know how I knew that? I had listened to you guys. I saw you guys go through similar stuff. So I knew that's what I needed to do. At this point, I was teachable. And I learned from watching what you guys had gone through in sobriety, and it worked for me. I was able to stay sober through that. My sister was on a flight from Europe into town when mom was passing. And the same time, almost within 10 minutes, the same time my sister's wheels landed at the airport, mom took her last breath within just a few minutes. So when I got back to the hospital, my sister was already there, and she said, where were you? And I told her, and if you knew my sister, she's one of these people you don't want to mess with. If she says, where were you? You better answer quick, and you better answer honestly. So I told her what happened. She said, good. She's always supported me in my sobriety, been a big, strong supporter of me in my sobriety. I thank her for that. So we were able to get through that, and that was huge. Another big thing that happened to me in sobriety, it was pretty bad. Not quite as bad, but pretty bad. I had been in a relationship for quite a while, about 5 years, and it went south. And it went south quick and in a bad way. During COVID, I had stepped away from the program. I didn't like the Zoom meeting stuff at all. It just wasn't my thing. And a friend of mine said, you need to get to a meeting. He called me and told me I needed to get to a meeting. And he said he knows of one that I need to get to. I go by and pick him up. And I believe, wasn't it Dave and Johnny's meeting? Or was it the parking lot meeting, Floyd?
Rogers,
yeah. The guys that were up here getting the 12 and 13 years, their meeting they go to, that was the meeting he took me to. It was still live. That made a huge difference, and that's when I met Johnny. And I'd already met Dave, but that's when I met Johnny. I got back into meetings. I'd already lost my place to live, but I knew what I needed to do. I needed to get back in touch with my AA people because that's where my salvation was. I was losing it quickly. And it wouldn't have been long before I went back to drinking. I probably would have died. So I got hooked up with some more meetings. After I get back to that live meeting, I got hooked up with some more meetings. And I went to the courthouse parking lot meeting. We were having a meeting right at the courthouse in Chula Vista, right in their parking lot. So if they had anything to say, they could come out and say it to us. We were going to stay sober. And that worked. And I saw my friend Dougie there. And I told him what was going on. And he says, I got a garage you can live in. What, a garage again? This one's actually a kind of a converted garage. It was almost a full-fledged apartment, but there was zoning things and stuff going on with it, but I was able to stay there long enough to get back on my feet. And that was another gift of sobriety, what I like to really call a gift from God, because that's what it was. God had my back again, got me back into these rooms, got me back on my feet. I got an apartment. And then my son asked me to move in with me. I said, yeah. Him and I get along now. First night there. Okay, you've seen that he's really tall, right? So first day there, he was there. He said, I want to rearrange the kitchen a little bit. I said, yeah, go ahead. Next morning I get up and coffee maker's there. I can't see the coffee anywhere. I'm looking around all over the place and I can't find the coffee. I finally look up and it's on the top shelf in the back. I had to get the little stepladder out, almost climb onto the counter to get to it. Get the coffee made, and I'm sitting there with my coffee, and he comes out, and he goes, oh, so you're able to get it. Did you get your stepladder? That's the kind of thing he does to me. You know, he's a good guy. And that's the kind of thing I get to have these days. That's the kind of relationship I get to have. The best part of this program, is helping new guys. That's the best part right there. It makes me feel like I'm doing something that makes a difference in somebody else's life. Somebody wants what I have. That's amazing. And it doesn't cost me anything to give it away. And I like it most of the time. Sometimes I get a little too involved with their... Too attached, and they don't make it. Those are the ones that break my heart. Those are the ones that hurt. But not all of them are like that. The ones that do make it are amazing. You get to watch them like they talk about in the book. A group builds up around them that's just amazing to watch. If you guys want what we have, if you're new here and you want what we have, I guarantee you get a phone number and call that phone number and they'll be more than happy to help you. More than happy to help you. Big part of that is picking up the phone. And that's a huge part. You know, I didn't know how heavy that phone was until I needed help. I was just looking at that thing like, I don't want to call him and tell him I've messed it up again. But that's the best way to get it fixed. Yeah. How many people in here have sponsors? All right. I like that. How many people have done the steps? I like that. How many people are actively doing the steps right now for the first time? All right, yeah. Okay. Now, keep this in mind. I like that a lot. Now, who's not working the steps? Who's not got a sponsor? Who's not planning on getting into any of these things? All right. Meet me out front. I'll go down and get you a drink because it's going to happen. If you're not done, don't waste our time. Get out there, get done, and get back here before you die. This disease wants to do two things. It wants to get you alone. It did me. And it wants you dead. And it almost got me. And I've seen it happen to a lot of men. They don't make it. And they don't get the chance to try it again. Rips my heart out of my chest sometimes. It's really bothersome to know that these people had the opportunity and they didn't make it because of the choices they made. Once you get this alcohol out of your system, you now don't have to obsess over it anymore. You now can take 10 minutes to change your mind. It's all it takes. I give out these little 10-minute tokens. And I tell people all the time, when you're thinking about drinking, grab that token, grab your phone, put a timer on your phone for 10 minutes. Just 10 minutes, that's all you need. Think about anything else other than drinking, anything. If at the end of 10 minutes, you're still thinking about drinking, you've got your phone in your hand, you better start calling numbers because you're in dangerous territory. Because all you need is 10 minutes at a time. If you can't do 24 hours, try 10 minutes. Now, I remember one of the times I was trying to get sober around here, a guy told me, 24 hours at a time. Go to a meeting every day and don't drink between meetings. Boy, I was pissed. I couldn't do that. All I'm asking for is 10 minutes at a time. If you put enough 10 minutes together, you'll get 24 hours. And before you know it, you'll be up here taking a 90-day token. You have no idea how fast that time can go. And I guarantee you, not drinking is a lot easier than having to figure out how you're going to get that next drink. Because for me, I was working as a machinist for cash so that I could have money to drink. You have any idea how hard it is to read a micrometer when your hands are shaking? Yeah, it doesn't work. Not very well. This guy I was working for down here, he would have me make a part in the morning, and if I made it to the specifications he wanted, he would let me make parts until noon. And then he would check me again at noon after lunch. You know what happens at lunch. If I wasn't able to make that part, he would have me sweep the floors. When I got here to the house, you guys told me I needed to clean house. I'm like, okay, I got to need to clean up my area, right? And I thought of this place where I'd been working for cash and all the empty bottles I had left stashed all over the place. So after my first 3 days of blackout here, where you had to stay on the property, I bolted down there and I told the guy, I says, I checked myself into a rehab. And he goes, really, what for? And then he started laughing at me. I said, I want to go in there and clean out all the bottles. He says, good, go get busy. I went in there and I found a bunch of them. Some of them still had booze in it. And I was only about maybe 5 or 6 days sober. That was shaky ground for me. But I was so afraid of alcohol at that point that I threw it all away. And when I got done with that, I felt so good about myself. I mean, wow, what an accomplishment. You know, most people would think, oh, yeah, you're cleaning up your mess, whatever. For me, that was huge because I didn't drink any of that booze. Huge. Got done with the day. The man paid me cash like he always did. And I was walking on the opposite side of the street from where I had always went for the liquor. I was on the opposite. I was that friend on the opposite side. I was going to walk to the nearest next bus stop so I wouldn't go near that bus stop. I was afraid. And I thought, you know what? I was able to do that, throw that booze away. I bet you I can do this too. So I went in that store and I bought tobacco and I bought a Dr. Pepper and I went to the counter and I put the Dr. Pepper down and he put the tobacco and he put a bottle of whiskey on there. That was scary. At that moment I said, I don't need that bottle. And I walked out of there without it. And when I got back here, first day I got back here, after being out there for the first time on my own, where nobody's watching, near alcohol, I got back here sober. I felt like a kid that had been playing tag and got back to home base when they didn't get him yet. I was safe from the world. This was a safe place, exactly what I needed at that moment. You have any idea how much confidence that gave me? A little bit. That's all I needed, was just a little bit of hope. Just a little bit. After that day, I was going out and I was putting, because your job here when you first get here is to get a job. I was going out there and I was putting applications in all over the place. Problem was, I didn't feel like I was being honest with these people. I didn't feel like I could do a job. And we're talking dishwashing, we're talking anything. I had no self-confidence about working anymore. And the guy that I had been working for cash for, I had talked to him before I left, and I told him I don't feel comfortable coming back until I get more sobriety. And he said, okay. So I didn't want to get over there and start making cash money every day, because that scared me. I'd been down that road, and I just knew it was going to happen. So I struggled for a few months here. And you know what was really cool about being here with that struggle happening? They didn't really give me a hard time about the rent. They told me, you know, you do need to pay rent. But they didn't give me a hard time about it. And then they let me work in the kitchen as a cook. Like, whoa, really? Yeah. I got to burn some food for you guys. Sorry about some of the Saturday nights. They weren't that great, but you know, hey, I was sober, okay? There were a few times in the kitchen that, you know, I learned a lot about sobriety being in that kitchen, because I'd be in there and between orders, I'd be listening to you guys out here sharing on the noon meeting. I got a lot of wisdom there. I met some really cool people in these rooms. I remember one time I was in there and I'd come out to serve somebody their food because they weren't picking it up. And I knew whose order it was. I came out here to put it down. And it just happened to be that the guy that was sharing it had finished and they called on me to share. It wasn't very often that I got to share during a noon meeting. And I was only a few months sober. I get up here and I start talking and I don't even know what I was talking about. To this day, I'm still not sure what I was talking about. And back there in the corner, I hear, what the hell does that have to do with sobriety, Cliff? I got an instant resentment. Instant resentment. Who do you think you are? And I said, okay, bye. And I walked over there, went back to my corner, and I stewed on it. And I got to thinking about it. Yeah, it's true. What the hell did that have to do with sobriety? And that changed how I shared. That changed how I got up here and talked about my sobriety. And I went to that man afterwards, and I thanked him. You guys know Motorcycle Don? Yeah. Oh, everybody knows. Yeah. He didn't put up with a bunch. I loved that guy. Floyd. He was in charge of the house when I was here. Well, he was a staff member of the house here. That was a fun time. You know, if I was in the, when I was in the house, you told me I'd be friends with that guy, I might have slugged you. Turns out that man was exactly what I needed. Exactly what I needed. Straight up and strong. Pardon me. Now, to the fun part. I get to have a lot of fun in sobriety. My favorite thing is Rule 62. Don't take yourself too seriously, ever. I have found a lot of things to do that's fun sober. When I found out that I remembered how to sail and how much fun I really enjoy, how much I really enjoy that, it lit a fire under me. I got busy again, kind of like some guys with their surfing. Or fishing. I get to go out there and have fun sailing. When I first got back into sailing, I was renting a boat. I'd get a group of people together, and we'd all chip in, and we'd rent the boat, and we'd go play on the bay. A couple of years back, I got the opportunity to buy a boat, a 27-foot sailboat. And I told the guy, I'm really not in the market for it, a sailboat. And he says, I said, what's your price? He says, for you, $1. I'm like, are you kidding me? He says, no, I need to get out from underneath the boat. I need it to go to somebody that's going to use it. I bought that boat, and I have used it like crazy. Judy loves it. And that's important to me. We went, her and I took it out to in front of the Rady Shell and listened to the Beach Boys from my boat. That was an awesome night. It was a great, great night. And these are the key kinds of things I get to do today. And one of my favorite things to say, well, two of my favorite things is, I can't control the wind, but I can adjust my sails. It's all about perspective. If you don't like what's going on, what can you change to make it better? And if you're not having fun in sobriety, you're probably doing it wrong. You've got to have fun. Why were we drinking? Because it was fun to begin with. If you really want to have some fun in sobriety, you really do, it's super important, or you're not going to keep on doing it. And I hope I got a message to the newcomers out there that understands just how much I really appreciate everybody in these rooms, including you. Thanks for being here for me.